Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have probably one of my favorite documentarians in the world. And I hope he refers his wife refers to him as that, as one of the greatest. David Barry's here, his film Midnight Muse. Welcome to the house again. Welcome.
Thank you. I hope you're washing your hands and staying inside.
Yeah, I was when I was working. Like I said, I'm on a two-week sabbatical because of weirdness, what's going on. But yeah, I have to wash my hands fully for what I do. So before we get into this, I think we got to start with you. Like, all your films are about music. How much do you love music?
Oh, music was everything to me. I mean, in my 20s, I played music. I wrote songs. I was in an original band. We nearly signed a couple distribution deals. So, I mean, we were doing it. And it just, you know, all the cards didn't line up. But music has always been my love. And so I got into filmmaking because I wanted to be able to, you know, make videos and do things for the music we were recording. You know what I mean? This is like the early 90s, and you know I'm a U2 fan, so Zoo TV was a big deal, right? So I wanted to be able to make our own video backdrops and make our own music videos, and that's why I got into film and television. And I just fell in love with telling musical stories. I relate to musicians. It's a very interesting thing. I've interviewed musicians and I've interviewed actors. And I've nothing against actors, but it's always very hard for me to get a grasp on who they are. They always just seem to be the last role they played. But a musician, you know who a musician is when you sit and you talk to them. And so I gravitate to those stories. I really, that's who I am, you know?
I think that's why I prefer to interview directors for the same reason you're giving me. Actors are fine, but they're playing a part.
Yeah.
And when you do musician, this is their music. This is their love. And I find that with a director, I can get more out of a director than I can out of an actor.
Yeah.
Because they can't answer questions for me. Some questions I would have on filmmaking, they have no idea. Because that's not what they do.
That's not what they do.
So your film Midnight Muse, I mean, we're looking at a very select period of music. But you do go in later in the film. So I guess we're going to start. How did you find out about this?
A wonderful woman in Las Vegas who is involved in the jazz scene in Las Vegas. Her name is Ann Parente, and she was the executive producer on the film. And she, you know, I wish I could take credit for the onus of the idea, but it was her idea. And, you know, they through mutual friends in Las Vegas who knew that I was a musical documentarian, I was brought out to do it. And so I went to Vegas and shot all the interviews and then put it all together. So, but that's how it started. She's a member of the jazz community there. And there were all these great musicians and she was learning their life stories and the things that happened. And she felt that was a story that needed to be told, and she was absolutely right. I mean, delving into it. I mean, I went to college in Las Vegas, so I knew a lot of lounge musicians, and I knew a lot of musicians, and I used to always hear stories about what it was like back in the heyday. And so, but I never knew any of those guys, so I got to meet a lot of them and talk with them, the guys who were still surviving. And man, it was, you know, it was chicken skin. It was goosebumps all the time talking to them.
So let's start at the beginning. Putting this film together, literally putting it together, did she know these musicians, or was it more like, hey, you talk to Joe, talk to Phil?
Kind of more like a little bit of both. There were some that she knew, and there were some who, you know, hey, I want to do this film. Do you know these people? Okay, talk to the music union, because the union still has, you know, track of some of these guys and things like that. And that got her put in touch with, Frank Sinatra's musical director and a lot of the others. And some were, a couple of guys were, instructors, I wouldn't even say that, professors at UNLV and things like that. So, it was kind of word of mouth and some of the people she knew, and then doors were opened. So she created a list, and then I just got in touch with everybody on the list, and the people who wanted to be interviewed, we just, you know, we filled out a spreadsheet and okay, this day, this time, that kind of thing.
So how did you find the old casino footage? Everything looks old.
A lot of searching. Yeah, we got some from the music union. I found some people on online who had stuff on YouTube, and then we emailed them and got permission to use it, things like that. A lot of looking, a lot of searching.
Was there a casino photo you couldn't find? I guess I should ask you that.
There definitely were. A couple of the old properties, and forgive me for not remembering the names right now, it was hard to get photos of them, and then it was even harder to get high-quality photos of them. By high quality, I literally even mean just the resolution. Like, to get an HD, you know, 1920 by 1080 photo of some of these places, you know, that when they're from the 50s, it's really hard, actually. Shockingly hard. We got some from the Nevada Historical Society. We got some from the Music Union. It was a group effort, a lot of research.
And now, in the film, you discuss a lot of 24 hours a day of music at the casinos, like nonstop.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that feel for you, being a musician, and you could have been a part of it?
Oh, I felt, you know, tingly talking to him, you know, like, oh, I wish I was around then. Yeah, I could picture it. Because when I moved to Las Vegas, I got to Las Vegas in 1991, and I went to UNLV. And I was there for, like, Jerry Tarkanian's last year with the Running Rebels, and I was there at the very, very end of when the mob kind of ran things and it was switching over to corporate. But it was still a small town when I got there, and so that 24-hour vibe was very real, and there was music everywhere. Everywhere had music. And it was nothing like what it used to be, right? But I understood the vibe and that feeling. And so when you talk to them and they would talk about just being able to go in and sit in with somebody at any time, or at the Union Hall, there was music going 24/7. That wasn't even a gig. They were just there playing, you know what I mean? And how amazing that had to be. Just, yeah. Unbelievable. And these guys are, you know, these aren't hacks. These are guys that are, you know, can sit down with a piece of sheet music that they've never seen before and perform it live. I mean, these are the best musicians in the world at the time. That's amazing, you know?
Now, they discuss relief bands, and that's a term I'd never heard of before. And they only play one night a week. And it sounds like these guys were just as good as the guys who played all the time.
Because they had to be able to sit in with anybody. You know, anybody's show, they had to be able to come in. It wasn't like you were just relieved for just one show. And the showrooms could change out. So because of the union hours and things like that, like everybody had to have at least one night off or something like that. And so you'd get called up and say, okay, you're playing at the Flamingo tonight, or you're playing at Caesars, or you're playing at, you know, the Four Queens or wherever. And whoever was there, you had to be able to walk in, look at the sheets, and play it. So, yeah, they were the guys who had the most amazing chops. And a couple of the guys liked doing that the best because it didn't get boring for them. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know what they were going to be playing, and so it was interesting for them.
I think my favorite story, it's right near the end. The guy discussed how he worked 6 days in a row, and he's off, and it's a Monday night. And he gets a call. I think it's Frank Sinatra. And he goes, where is he? He's got to be here. And he gets a goal. He has to show up.
Yeah.
And the mob boss says, okay, just give me the bill. And the guy gets his money. He's like, what?
It's really how that town worked. It really is. It's how that town worked at that time.
I thought that was a
good insight into it, you know?
I thought that was a fast.
Whatever. They don't care.
No. I mean, money must have been just a plenty back then, the way the guys are talking.
Well, you think about it, and that's the thing that's sad, because I know so many musicians today in Las Vegas, and some of them they're doing okay, right? But this was a time in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s where if you were a musician, you could move to Las Vegas and not just make a living, but you could thrive. You could have a family. You could buy a home. You could provide for your family with it, you know? And it was stable. It wasn't jumping from gig to gig. It was really a very special time. And, you know, once the corporations got in and it just changed it all, you know. So, and then DJs and, you know, they didn't value it the same.
Well, you do hit on that in your thing. You do discuss tape, how the union didn't want tape. Yep. And it took me a couple minutes to figure out what they were talking about. Obviously, you being a musician would understand tape instantly. And I'm like, what? Oh, I get it. Background music, pre-done ahead
background of
time.
Playback. Yeah, they didn't want that. So they wanted to keep their guys working.
No, I understood that. Did you I know as a documentarian, I should have known that maybe, but did you think at some point in the film you should explain that to me? Because you didn't. I did figure it out. It took me a few minutes.
You know what? I honestly think that's, you know, no film is ever perfect. So, yeah, I probably should have asked to have them explain that. That is probably, if I think about my biggest fault in filmmaking, is that I get so into my conversation with whoever I'm interviewing that if I have any kind of knowledge about it, I don't interrupt and I don't think to say, oh, you know what, I should have that explained, because I'm just, it's just like right now, it's just you and I, right? It's that kind of same thing. But yeah, I didn't even think about that. Probably should have.
Oh, just a weird, it was just me not knowing, maybe the ignorance of me. I do know it now. It took me, like I said, it's the 1-1000, 2-1000. Okay, now I know what they're talking about. Did you ever do a documentary, which I've never seen one in the three we've done, where you actually talk? You're never on film.
Nope, I never am. Never on film.
And why is that?
Because it's not about me. I mean, I'm the least part of the thing. You know, my job is to be a fly on the wall and pull the stories out. When I'm talking to people, I'm a big believer in when I'm filming, I try to make my footprint as small as possible. I try not to overlight or have too many crew guys. I try to narrow it down so when that person just sits down in front of me, it's just a conversation between me and them. I'm a big believer that that's how you get the best content. And I also, like, I always go into it where I know the things I want to ask, but I also know that when somebody gets asked to be interviewed, even if it's subconscious, they have things that they want to talk about. So part of my job is to get out of that way and let it unfold very naturally. And the stories will always go where the stories go. You know what I mean? My films are always kind of like a big conversation. That's the way I like to cut my films together. So you might have one person bring up an idea and then I cut to somebody else who, you know, builds on that idea. And then another person, you know, so I feel like there's no need for me and there's no need for narration in that way.
Now, when you were interviewing them, did you ever have a chance that you missed somebody? Maybe you just missed somebody. They passed on or they didn't want to do it or everybody was fair, wanted to chat.
With Midnight Muse, everybody we wanted to chat with was there, and a few of those people have passed away since then. I need to update the credits on it to do a memorial portion to it because – we've lost three of the musicians that are interviewed in the film.
I would guess it's the guy playing the sax would be one of them.
Yep.
Just because he looked old at the time. I mean, to me, he looked in his 80s.
Yep. Tony, one of the black guitar players.
Yeah.
He passed away. And there's one more. The woman who runs the jazz, who had run the jazz community in Vegas and was married to a famous composer, she passed away.
Actually, she's one of my favorite people in your film. I think she's very bright.
Yeah, she's fantastic. She passed away too. So I need to do a memorial page to it, and I'll change what's available because that's important.
Now, there's something we can discuss. I know we're supposed to be on your film. Do you feel as a filmmaker you should go back to your film and correct it because you're a documentarian?
I do occasionally. Like, Seeds of Aloha, I just updated because it was the very first Hawaiian film I did and it was really important to George and I to tell the story of his life, right? And his life is so much more about all the other things he did than just the music. And then as I did the rest of the Hawaiian films, I noticed that, you know, we needed to have those live performances in there. So I went back like 3 years later and I filmed George playing on his farm and inserted all of these performances into it. With Dream Out Loud, I'm still updating things occasionally with it. I just feel like a film is never truly done. It's just abandoned eventually. And if there's something that I want to – that I feel that strongly about, I'll make a change.
Okay. Let's go back to your film now. I notice every musician would harp on two things. They would say gangsters did it better in corporations. They do discuss Steve Wynn. They do discuss that. They said they just did it better. And the one thing that shocked me at one point, there were no all black bands.
Nope.
Segregation still existed.
Yeah, segregation was a big deal in Las Vegas for a long time, and that's because it was an Italian mafia town. And, you know, I don't want to – I don't want to say that there was a racist element to it, but apparently there was, you know, and they just, they did things the way they did things. Frank Sinatra was a, you know, he gets a lot of credit for that, but he was, you know, a big part of starting to break down that wall, because they tried to segregate how Sammy Davis could perform with him, or how he'd have to enter the building, or this or that. And Frank said no to it. And they wanted Frank. So you had to do what Frank said. And that was a crack in the wall. And then it slowly got broken down. But to hear some of those stories about those guys having to, like, not even be able to stay in the same area of town. Like, they had to stay in, like, a black neighborhood or whatever. It was shocking to me. But it's, you know, not a portion of the city's history that I would think they would be proud of.
No, I just expected, I guess, in the sense, because it was Vegas and it was showmanship and it's Sammy Davis Jr. was there. And I guess that's maybe the reason why I was thinking that segregation didn't exist in Vegas.
No, it did. They wanted you on the stage, but then they wanted you to go right back out through, you know, the kitchen door and go and stay in your side of town. They didn't get to stay in the same hotel rooms, things like that.
You do a tiny bit of casino shooting, I've noticed, inside the casino. At least I think you are in a couple shots in the newer stuff.
Maybe.
Now, was that allowed? Did you have to get casino permission or no?
Yeah, we get permission to do that. So you get in touch with the marketing department and you say, hey, we're working on a film and, you know, we need to shoot this or we need to shoot that. And typically, as long as you're not showing gambling, you're okay, but you have to have permission. We were allowed to shoot some exteriors, and then the gambling footage I have is paid for. So they had to, you know, there are strict rules to that, but we did actually do some shooting inside of the Palms and a couple others.
Hold on. You have to pay for gambling footage?
Yeah, to get the footage of like a craps table. You know, I think I had some shots of dice falling, you know.
You do?
Yeah, you have to pay for that.
Why?
Because you're not allowed to actually shoot somebody filming on the floor actually playing. And there's a couple ways around it as a filmmaker. I've done a lot of things because, you know, I spent time in Vegas. So one of the things we used to do in Las Vegas to get our gambling footage is that the hotel department at UNLV has an awesome simulated casino setup in a room, right? It's a big giant, like, it's like a, you know, it's like a banquet room, but they've got slots in there. They've got all the games and they actually teach people how to be dealers and things like that in there. And so you could get into there and rent it for much less money than what it costs to, you know, try and get a section of a casino floor, which, you know, for the budgets I get to work with, we'd never even be in the discussion to do that because it costs millions of dollars to do that. So, like, if you see like a Hollywood feature where like let's think about the Ocean's movies, right? They're actually shooting inside of casinos, but they've paid enough money to be able to block off an entire section of a casino floor and then fill it with nothing but extras, and then do their thing, right? But you're not allowed to actually shoot on a live floor where there's actual patrons, for privacy reasons. So you have to get permission to, you know, you can't shoot in there. So you pay for that footage, right? And if you look at that footage that I have, other than the footage from the 50s where, you know, we've got shots of, or, and photos of the inside of like the Flamingo or something, but anything that's like more, modern, footage, if you notice, you don't see people in it. It's just the shots of like a roulette wheel or something like that. And that's on purpose because it would be too expensive to get it the other way.
So did you find there was a difference between the musicians that played in the 50s, 60s, 70s as musicians today? I mean, the ones today I know speak fondly, wishing they were there.
Yeah, they were, you know, they're different kind of cats, you know, to use a jazz phrase for them. You know, they were definitely different guys. They had a different look about them and a different way they looked at their job. The guys in the 50s were diehard union guys, you know, because it's what created their lives for them, and the 60s and the 70s. When you get into the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, you know, everything had kind of gotten destroyed. And so those guys were more just looking out for themselves because they're just looking for a job. I don't mean that they were self-centered, but I mean they, you know, they could be in the union, but it didn't have the same power. You see what I'm saying? So they had to be much more involved in self-marketing and taking care of themselves with their careers. Whereas, you know, the guys earlier in that, the union took care of everything. You know what I mean? You were a union member. I mean, that was your ticket. You know what I mean? So there was a difference.
Scott, I forgot my next question. I'm really sorry.
Music that they had to play. You know, the guys in the 50s and 60s, they were playing in giant orchestras. You know what I mean? And so they had sheet music. And the guys now, they're playing stuff that, you know, some of them can play that way. But the rest of them are playing, like, that are more controlled sets that are written out. And it's a different kind of music. It's not orchestrated in the same way. So
I'm going to put you on the hot seat. Do you see the players now aren't as good as the players then, or they don't have a chance to be?
No, there's monster players still. That Santa Fe band that's in the film, those guys are monsters. And there's another band in Vegas called the Lon Bronson All-Star Band. It's made up of people who play at other casinos, and they get together, like, I think once a week. And I think they're still doing it. And it's just guys who, you know, they're not working that night, so they all come in and sit in. It's a bit of a revolving lineup, but they're monsters, absolute monster players. So, they're still there, but the average lounge that you see live music in is going to have very competent musicians, but not the type of musicians that played in the 50s who were so trained, because it's a different type of music they're playing now.
I remembered my question. Vegas get its jazz festival?
No, not yet.
Really?
They're still doing. They have jazz events, but they don't have a Las Vegas jazz festival.
Now I want to do the direction of your film. I thought the first three quarters were definitely on the old people. Then you switched to the new people, mm-hmm. And I did like how you touched on that when you went into the jazz thing a little bit more, that how they. People get together at different bars on different nights and have different things. I thought that was really cool. And I didn't expect the film to go that way. Do you get that comment a lot from people?
No, because most of the people who watch the film are you know, from the Vegas area or Vegas musicians. It aired on PBS in Vegas. And I've never really done a Q&A on it, but most of those people were kind of from that kind of community. So I think that they understood that, you know. That story kind of flows in a bit of a chronological way with a little bit of a look back at the end. And so, you know, it would be natural. If you think about the 50s, there were places they went to play too, but because they had the Union Hall and everybody was there, that was the hangout. And that's where they all went to play. Well, that's gone now. So now they've got, you know, they've got a couple different clubs that they go to, you know, for their, you know, industry nights, kind of.
Did you ever thought of putting a shot in of where the Union Hall was?
I did not. That would have been good to do. You know, I'm not perfect.
Sorry, I just, because you
it was behind. It was behind the Tropicana Hotel. The building isn't there anymore. You'd be looking at a literally like an empty parking lot. But I think that's why we didn't do it, is because the building isn't actually there. Like if there had still been a building there, but it was something else, then it would have made more sense to do it. I think just showing an empty parking lot would have felt, I don't know, a little sad to me.
Yeah, because I mean,
on the fire, we did touch on the fire and what happened, but. Yeah, I mean, it's just a piece of lost history. And I think the optimist in me wanted to try and keep it, you know, more positive.
No, I agree with it. They just all talk about this Union Hall. So even if you showed me and say, look,
I wish it was still there, I do. It would have been great to go in there and see these old-timers hanging out with some of the young guys just playing, you know? It would have been great.
Well, it sounds like they had to sell it for the money. That's what the one guy says. He finally touched. One guy tells us the story of what really happened.
Yeah, but there was a fire, too. Maybe that didn't make it into the film.
I don't think it did.
The building's gone, though. So, I'm pretty sure it was a fire. You know what? It could have been, too, just the way Vegas moves. Vegas has a tendency to eat its own, and it destroys its history. So, the building may have been plowed over for, you know, to make more space. It's entirely possible, too. But, yeah, they had to sell it. And I think it got sold to the Tropicana Group. And, yeah, I know there was – I thought somebody said it burned down in a fire, but I don't remember.
Do you feel that music in Vegas will ever go back? Because they do discuss some of the people having bands back now.
Not to the way it was. Because the – the bottom line is just the way they run these places now, they're not willing to spend that kind of money to create that kind of experience for people. Certain showrooms, like Celine Dion, has a big orchestra. So some of the major acts that come into town, they get that. But, you know, whereas every hotel had an orchestra, that'll never happen again.
Fair enough. I don't have any more questions. You ready for some fun questions I'm going to have to make up off the top of my head?
Sure.
The last record you bought, or CD, DVD, whatever you would like it to be?
The last record I bought. I pre-ordered Brian Fallon's new one called Wild Horses.
Last song you listened to and enjoyed?
The last song that I listened to and enjoyed. Gosh, that's a tough one. I listen to music every single day.
I know you do. That's why I put this on.
The last thing I listened to and enjoyed, I was out just before I got on here with you about an hour ago. I was out in the garden working. I was listening to U2's there's a live recording they made for their fan club from their last tour. A song called Acrobat Live, which I really enjoyed.
Why am I not shocked it was a U2 song? I don't know why. The next person you see in concert.
You know what? That's a great question. And isn't it sad that we have to wonder when that's going to be able to be right now because of what's going on in the world, right?
I understand that, but I know you. You have something in mind.
Okay. I really want to see Bruce Springsteen play again, and he was supposed to go out on the road in 2020. I was born and raised in Jersey. I've always loved Bruce Springsteen as a songwriter. I think he's America's greatest songwriter.
Hold on.
I don't have the same spiritual and emotional connection to his music as I do with U2, right? But I love Bruce, and I've seen him many times. I haven't seen him since Clarence Clemens passed away, but now I'm feeling like I really want to see him one more time in my life because he's 70 years old. I don't know how long he's going to play for. So that was something I was really looking forward to, but I have no idea if that'll be able to happen.
Even though I'm going to get hate mail, is he better than Dylan?
I don't know. I wouldn't say he's better. It's different time frames. I just I don't think you can compare the two. I don't think you can say one is better than the other. Dylan, I mean, Dylan's Dylan. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? Well,
you're saying Bruce is the best, and I'm saying I think Dylan's a better songwriter. I think Bruce is a better musician.
Yeah. I would have to agree with that. But I just think that Bruce is like – but Dylan's a poet too. I think you got to put them both up there, and it's like, you know, Pepsi or Coke in a way. You know what I mean?
Fair enough.
But I'll agree with this. I will say this. This is a great conversation to have. I don't think you could have a Bruce Springsteen without a Bob Dylan. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it just couldn't have happened. So, whereas I think Bruce might be a little bit more musical than Dylan is because Bruce writes a lot more music than Bob does, but it's Bob Dylan, man. You know what I mean? You know, there's just no way around that. For me, I like Bruce a little better. I'll word it better that way. I like Bruce a little better. And it could just because I grew up in New Jersey. It could also, you know what it could really be too? I've never had the chance to see Bob Dylan live, and I've seen Bruce Springsteen probably 7 or 8 times. So if I saw Bob live, I, you know, it might be a completely different conversation.
I have seen Bob Dylan live.
What was it like? Was it good?
It was okay. Yeah. I'm not, my girlfriend at the time was a huge Dylan fan, so I got to see Santana opened.
Oh, really?
And then Dylan, but we'll talk about it after. Tell everybody where they can find your movie. Amazon Prime now, I think, you just told me?
Yes, yes.
And is this the cut that I saw, or is there a different cut now? Because I know you like to play.
So, it's the cut you saw.
Okay, great. So, everybody, please check out this film on Amazon Prime. It's full recommend from me. And thank you for your time, as always.
It's great to talk to you.
Have a great night.